Exodus chapter 20 verses 1 to 17. The 21st talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on February 26, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 19, Exodus 20, verses 1 through 17, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're getting back into the book of Exodus. We've gone through the first 19 chapters of Exodus, and those 19 chapters have all been historical narrative. But at this point, it is going to change. It will not be historical narrative for the rest of the book, except for there's a chapter here and there that lapses into historical narrative. But the rest of it is a description of the laws, the tabernacle that's supposed to be built, and then later it's going to come back and talk about the actual construction of the tabernacle. So the last half of the book is all devoted to those kinds of issues and is no longer historical narrative. I wanted to do Exodus. I did it a number of years ago, but I just did the historical narrative part of it. And I wanted to do Exodus again because I wanted to do the rest of it, to force myself to do the rest of it. And part of that was to get my feet wet in the biblical law. The law is a fairly large portion of the first five books of the Bible, of the Pentateuch. And it seems to me that it is the kind of thing that we need to get some kind of handle on in order to understand what God is doing. And yet it is probably the least teachable part of the Bible except for genealogies. But we're going to launch into it very audaciously. Talking about the law is going to require some background, and I will be talking about giving some of the background this week, and I'll be giving more background next week. I had planned to do a lot more background work. There's a lot that can be done. There's a lot that has been written on the Old Testament law and the nature of the Old Testament law, and that's primarily what I was interested in learning. But I was unable to do all that I wanted to do. I had to cut that short, but I will be introducing some of that, and that's a project that I want to come back to in my own studies. So we'll be jumping in chapter 20, but since it's been a while, I'm going to start out by giving a brief review of the first half of Exodus. Then I'm going to go through the Ten Commandments that are presented in the first part of chapter 20. I'm going to go through those one by one. And then if there's time, I want to talk about the nature of the law a little bit. It'll be some introductory comments to that topic, and then we'll talk about that more next week. Okay, so an overview of what has happened in Exodus. And this is stuff that you, I'm sure you all are familiar with, but I'll rehearse it for you all, both for your benefit and for mine. God entered into human history in an interesting way with the person of Abraham. Man, who he had created, proved himself to be a wayward creature and apparently incorrigibly wayward. And so what God did was he picked an individual man who is nondescript. It's not for any of his merits that he was picked. God seemed to have done so at random, but he picked Abraham and he said, I'm going to bless you. And I am going to bless you, and along with that, God was going to transform Abraham into a different kind of person. And that's what he did. And he made promises to Abraham that he would have descendants beyond number, and that God would bless his descendants and bless all that blessed his descendants. So Abraham lived out his life. God, over the course of Abraham's life, builds into him a confidence that God is who God says he is, and God would do the things that God promises to do. And Abraham came to believe that. Those promises were passed on to Abraham's descendants, Isaac and then Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. Those sons didn't get along terribly well. And 10 of them conspired against one of them, who was particularly arrogant and who was particularly liked by his father. It aroused jealousy and hatred on the part of the other brothers. They kidnapped him, were going to kill him, but instead sold him into slavery. That son went down to, was sold into slavery into Egypt. Jacob and his family ran into difficulties as a result of a famine that came upon the land. And desperate for food, Jacob sent his sons down to Egypt, where the only place where food was available to get food. And it was there that they, surprisingly, were reunited with their brother. Their brother had worked his way from being a slave up to being the second most important man in the country. And Joseph was very generous towards his brothers, forgave them for what they had done, and made provision for the whole family to come down to Egypt and to have food and survive the famine. So that's what they did. They moved down, Jacob and all of his clan moved down to Egypt and lived out the famine there. They not only lived out the famine there, but they lived for a lot longer than that. Joseph had arranged for them to settle on the edge of Egypt. Joseph was concerned that Egypt could be a bad place for them in the long run. And as a result, he settled them on the edge of Egypt. It is 400 years later, then, that Exodus picks up the action. It's 400 years later that things have become particularly bad for the people of Israel. They had been enslaved, and the Pharaoh had become concerned about their increase in numbers and was taking measures to reduce their numbers. He instructed that all of the baby boys born to the Hebrews be put to death. It's at that time then that Moses was born. Moses was born and miraculously saved from death. His parents put him in a basket, put that basket in the Nile. The daughter of the Pharaoh came down to bathe, and she discovered this baby, and she wanted it for herself. She wanted to adopt it, and she took it home, and her father, Pharaoh, couldn't say no to it, and she raised that boy in Pharaoh's household. That was the beginning of God taking action then on behalf of Israel to free them from their situation in Egypt. And I cannot stress enough that it was 400 years between the time that Jacob went down to Egypt and God took action to redeem them from Egypt. God takes his time. We see all kinds of examples of that in Exodus itself, but you see it elsewhere in the Bible. God takes his time. For all appearances, God wasn't doing anything for 400 years to alleviate the condition of the Israelites in Egypt. Moses grew up. When he was 40 years old, he begins to do some things to try to better the situation for his people. He identifies with the Hebrews. He was raised as the son of Pharaoh, but he identifies with the Hebrews. He knows that's where he came from, and that's who he identifies with. And he feels like he's in this situation where he had a privileged upbringing and was raised into a position of power and influence, and yet his people are suffering. And he feels an obligation to do something to alleviate that suffering. And he begins to take action, and the action that he takes is to, he apparently is trying to alleviate the rigor of enslavement and slavery on his people, and takes it out on the slave masters that are mistreating the Israelites. And in one case, he kills one of those Egyptian slave masters who was abusing the slaves, thinking that he had done it secretly and that no one knew that he had done it. But right afterwards, he goes to break up a conflict between two Hebrews, and one of those Hebrews says, "Who made you the boss of us? Why do you think that you are so high and mighty over us? And besides, I saw what you did yesterday." So Moses knows that his own people have rejected him, and he knows that he is in jeopardy, that there are Hebrews that know what he did, and they would be willing to tell on him. So he takes off, flees for his life, goes into the wilderness, and is in the wilderness for 40 years. And during that time, he's decided, my people, I want nothing to do with them. They rejected me. There's nothing I can do to help them. I'm just going on with my life. They can rattle their chains in Egypt, but I'm done with them. God comes to Moses at that point in time and tells Moses, I've got a job for you. I want you to go back to Egypt, and I want you to lead the Hebrews out of that country. And Moses is saying, no, I'm not doing it. They won't listen to me. It's a futile exercise. I'm not well suited to it. No, go pick somebody else. But God talks to him, addresses his concerns one by one, and gently brings him along. And Moses reaches the place where he is willing to comply with what God is asking him to do. So Moses goes back to Egypt, and he talks to Pharaoh, and he says, Pharaoh, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, no way. It's not going to happen. So God instructs Moses to bring about a series of plagues. Moses is to tell Pharaoh these plagues are coming. And one by one, those plagues happen. And one by one, Pharaoh refuses to let the people go. There is a sense in which he softens over time, but there's another sense in which he is no more willing to, he's no more on board with the idea of them going. The 10th and final plague was a plague that was going to be afflicted on all of the firstborn. God told the people of Israel, kill a lamb, take the blood from the lamb, and paint it on the doorposts of your house. Then go inside, eat your meal, and be ready to go. And God sent his angel of death then to over Egypt. And every house that had the blood painted on the doorposts, God spared the firstborn there. But in every other house, the firstborn died, both of men and animals. At that point then, Pharaoh reluctantly says, get out of here, go. And Moses leads the people of Israel out of Egypt. They leave, and they start heading towards the desert, but God directs them in kind of a circuitous route, and Pharaoh sees that they aren't going in a direct line, and Pharaoh's starting to think, I shouldn't have let them go. I could have had all that manpower still in my hands, and I let it slip out. I'm going to go get them. So he sends his army to go and get them and bring them back. The Israelites find themselves pinned against the Reed Sea or the Red Sea. They're pinned against a body of water. There's no place for them to go, and Pharaoh's army is coming, and the chariots are all arriving on the scene. And God miraculously then opens up the water, and the people of Israel are able to walk through on dry ground. They were able to escape when no escape seemed to be possible. And then, as soon as they go through, Pharaoh's army comes rushing in after them, and God says, nope, closes up the water, and they all drown. So they are destroyed. So the people of Israel are able to get to the other side of the sea, and Pharaoh's army that was pursuing them is absolutely destroyed. They continue then through the desert, and in very godlike fashion, 3 days later, they're out of water. They've gone through all of this, and I'm sure they're thinking, God has brought us through all this stuff, now it's clear sailing. But it wasn't clear sailing. They ran out of water. But God gives them water. And they move on. But they move out, they run out of meat. But God gives them meat miraculously. They're out of bread. But God gives them bread miraculously. And that in the most interesting form, that is food, manna, that they can find on the ground every day. And they can go out and harvest that manna, and that can be their food. But it only lasts for a day. They can only store up enough for one day. So God puts them in a situation where they have enough. They have enough water. They have enough food. But it's just enough. And I'm sure we've all experienced that kind of situation. That's not pleasant. What you would like to have is a month's worth. Or more. To have just that day's allotment is very difficult over an extended period of time. That's very difficult. And yet that is exactly what God had required of the people of Israel. Throughout this time, God had given them not only the food, but he had a pillar of fire by night and cloud by day that was leading them and demonstrating God's presence. But as I'm sure we all recognize, it's so easy to take God for granted, and that's exactly what the Israelites did. They took that presence of God for granted. Things weren't as comfortable as they wished they had been. Not only did they run out of water and food by spells, or run low on water and food, they were attacked by the Amalekites as well. But God led them in victory against the Amalekites also. So God's constantly with them, taking care of them, but they just have enough and no more. As a result, when there are shortages, the people become very upset because they're thinking, man, we had it so good in Egypt. We may have been slaves, but we had food. Here, we have no food. It's very risky here. It's an uncomfortable situation to be in. So think when they ran out of water, when they ran out of meat, they would accuse Moses of having done them ill because he brought them out of a place where they had food at least to a place where there's no food and they can't get food on their own. At the same time, they are becoming dependent on Moses. Moses is the one who has been the intermediary between God and them all along. And there's a sense in which they're becoming dependent on him. And you can see indications in Exodus that Moses is trying to wean them of that dependence, that he's trying to set up structures that will make it possible for them to continue to have their life and have good order in their society without his presence. And he sets up their system of adjudication to deal with complaints. So that's what's been happening as they make their way through the desert, through the wilderness, and they go, they make their way to Mount Sinai, which is the place where God had appeared to Moses to give him the assignment to go back to Egypt. God had appeared to him there, and he had said, you will come back here, and you'll bring my people back here, and we'll meet again. So that's where things leave off in chapter 19. They have arrived at Mount Sinai. And God has told them, I am going to appear to you. And we are going to make an agreement. We're going to make an agreement whereby I will be your God and you will be my people. And we just not need to talk about the details of that agreement. And the people are very amenable to that. They say in verse 8 of chapter 19, and all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And given that assurance on the part of the people, God has them prepare themselves and the agreement is going to be formalized. Up to this point in Exodus, what we have seen is a very one-sided relationship. God has done everything. There's been very little required of the people of Israel. But now God's going to explain what it is that he requires. Sarna, in one of the books that is wonderful, I really like his stuff. He says, God's redemptive acts on Israel's behalf require a reciprocal response on the part of Israel. The liberated multitude of erstwhile slaves must be united not only by a vital sense of a shared tragedy and a common experience of emancipation, but even more by bonds of perceived ideals, a vision of a new order of life, namely the establishment of an essentially different kind of society from what had hitherto existed. So God is going to use the experience that they have been through up to now, as well as the things that he is going to ask of them to do now, to create for himself his own special people. He had said that he wanted to make them his own possession among all the peoples, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And that's what he's going to do. So the people they spend 3 days preparing themselves for God to appear before them on Mount Sinai. And three times it is stressed that nobody is supposed to go on the mountain except for Moses and Aaron. So then the day comes when God appears to them, and there is fire and thunder and earthquake and all the audio visuals that you could hope for. in the appearance of God. And then God speaks to them. So chapter 20 then is describing what it is that God requires of them. What is it that God wants them to do as their part of this arrangement that he is making, this unique arrangement that he's making with this particular group of people? Okay, so that begins the law. It'll start with the Ten Commandments, and then it will move on to some other, move on to case law. Let me just make a few introductory comments about Old Testament or law in the ancient world in general. There is a lot of law that has been discovered that comes from the ancient Near East. Quite a bit of it was found in the late 1800s, and then a lot more was found in the early 1900s, but they are continuing to find tablets in Mesopotamia even to this day. And in fact, one of the results of the Iraq War was a lot of ground was stirred up. When it was bombings or whatever, there was a lot of ground that was disturbed, and there were a lot of old tablets that were excavated as a result of that. So there are additional tablets that are being found all the time, adding to the collection of tablets that we already had. So the number of tablets at this point is huge. It's hundreds of thousands. And the tablets, I assume you know what I'm talking about, but just in case you don't, in Mesopotamia, ancient Mesopotamia, many of the documents were written on these clay pads, and typically the way it was written was a stylus, which has a little arrow kind of figure at the end of it, and that would be stamped into the clay in different patterns to make the letters. That's called cuneiform. And then those tablets, when they dry, then they last a long time, fortunately, a very long time. And if they burn, they last even longer. And then they're baked clay. It's like pottery, and it lasts a very long time. And one of the nice things about a city getting sacked and burned is a lot of those clay tablets got baked. And so we have whole libraries that were of clay tablets that were stacked on wooden planks in a library, and when that burned down and those planks burned, it fired all of those clay tablets. So it is very fortuitous that we have all these clay tablets. If those things had been written on papyrus or even on leather, those would have been gone, because they were so old. But we have hundreds of thousands of them. And a large percentage of those deal with law. There are cases, there are legal codes written down, there are recordings from court proceedings, there are judgments. There are all kinds of tablets that exist that give us insight into the laws that existed in the ancient world. So I've been reading about these laws and have been a little surprised at what I have learned. The ancient Near Eastern laws, regardless of where they come from, whether they come from Sumer, whether they come from Babylon, whether they come from Assyria, whether they come from Egypt, whether they come from the Hittite kingdom in Turkey, they are all extremely similar. Very many of the laws are the same. They are generally organized much the same. There exist what are called law codes, which is a compendium of laws. And typically, those compendiums of laws come in the form of what they call case law. That is to say, instead of having what we have, which is often called statutory law, where you've got, if you've got a section in the law that talks about murder, then we'll talk about manslaughter. We'll talk about first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and what those are and what kinds of penalties you have for each one. That's not what you have in these compendiums of laws in the ancient world. Instead, what you have is, more typically, is if there's this kind of situation, that it, we'll take an example. If your ox gores your neighbor's ox and your neighbor's ox dies, then this is what should happen. So it's in this particular situation, this is a good judgment. This is a good resolution to the problem. And so it's these collections of particular situations that have occurred and have been adjudicated in an exemplary fashion. They are usually in a seemingly random order. There just be one after another of these very very situational bound judgments that are made. But they're the same throughout. So you'll find, if you find that one case of an ox goring somebody else's ox and it dies, you can find that same one repeated in the different cultures. And yet there are other kinds of situations that clearly would have been common that don't show up in any of them. So the amount of overlap is quite amazing. Another thing that's significant here is we're talking about a very long span of time. If we're talking about Sumer, that's, what, 3500 BC. And if we're talking about the Hittite, we're talking about 1,000-something, 1,200 or something like that. And yet, the laws are virtually the same. So they didn't change over time. The Old Testament laws are going to fit right into this pattern. The same case law instances that we find in the other cultures seem to be repeated in the Old Testament as well. So there's clearly a lot of cultural interchange here that's taking place, and the Israelites are right in that stream of cultural exchange. The fact that the Old Testament, that the law that God gives, is very similar to the law that was circulating in the ancient world in general, it is not terribly surprising if you think about it, because there are certain principles of right and wrong that God has built into the universe that any society that pays attention to what it's doing is going to decide that murder is a bad thing, that theft is a bad thing, etc. So it shouldn't be surprising that there would be a lot of overlap between the laws that God gives to Israel and the laws that the other countries are following, because a lot of those laws emerge out of the law that God built into the universe and is there to be seen. The Old Testament law tends to be a little bit more humane, not dramatically so, but a little bit more humane than the law codes elsewhere. But the biggest difference is, and we'll talk about this on several occasions, the law represents God differently. And we'll see that the religious law that God gives them is presenting rituals and things that they are supposed to do that are similar to rituals that are carried out in the other cultures. But there are some significant differences there, and the rituals end up saying a different thing. So the religious law draws on the language and vocabulary of the culture of the area, but it says different things with that language. And we'll be talking about that more. The law as it is presented by God to the people of Israel seems to take the form of a vassal treaty. Now, a vassal treaty is a treaty that's established between one country and another country. There are two kinds of treaties that were formed between different countries. One is a treaty between peer countries. They are equal in strength. And since they're equal in strength, the treaty is very balanced. And when it's that kind of treaty, it takes a certain form. If it is a treaty between a country that has conquered another country and the country that it conquers, then it's called a vassal treaty. And it takes a different literary form. What is presented by God to the people of Israel follows the pattern of a vassal treaty. And God is in the position of, in this vassal treaty, of the country that conquered the other country. It's the one that's in the dominant position, the conquering position, not in the conquered position. In Exodus, it doesn't follow that form as closely as it does in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, it is much clearer that this arrangement is a vassal treaty that's being made between God and the people of Israel. And by format, what I'm talking about is there, and I don't remember all, I think there are like 9 different elements. That is, there it says who the parties to the agreement are, who the witnesses are, what is the history of the relationship between the parties, what is expected of each party, and what are the consequences if the agreement is not lived up to, and what are the benefits that come if it is. So those are the basic parts of a vassal treaty. Okay, so God now is going to give his treaty, his vassal treaty, the terms of his treaty to the people of Israel. In all likelihood, what they're expecting is a whole bunch of rituals that they are supposed to perform. Very little along the lines of moral requirements, because that was not a big part of the religion of the ancient world. The rituals were a much bigger part of what they did and how the way that they related to God. So they were probably expecting that that's what God would require of them. I read one book, it said, the gods of the ancient world apparently couldn't feed themselves, because most of religion was dealing with how to make sure that the gods got fed. So that's probably what they are expecting. And they're probably also expecting that God is going to be another god in the pantheon of gods, of which they will be the favorite. They will be the favorite of that particular god, but there will still be this whole array of other gods that are out there and to be worshipped and served. But what they get does not match what they probably expected to get. The next 3 chapters of Exodus, 20 through 22, are oftentimes called the covenantal code, because this is what God is requiring of them. These are the laws. These are the civil laws that God is requiring. The first part in chapter 20, we get what are called the Ten Commandments. It's literally in Hebrew, it's the ten words. But these are the most basic concepts that God expects the people of Israel to adhere to. Then in chapters 21 and chapter 22 and going into chapter 23, it's going to have the case law. So these are specific instances, what would be the right judgment in specific sets of circumstances. And those are divided into two parts. The first part are the mishpatim, or the rules, and the second part are the devarim, or the commands, and we'll talk about that next week. The Ten Commandments that we see first in chapter 20 are interesting in that they are extremely short. There's very little explanation on about three of the commands. We'll see some explanation, but otherwise they're very short. There are no punishments given. This section is not encouraging people to think in terms of a cost-benefit analysis. What would the penalty be if I did X? They are just being told, don't do X. The Ten Commandments then constitute kind of a preface to the law. These are the most foundational principles that all of the rest of the law just fills out. It's just commentary on these principles. And within these principles, there are two parts. There are two parts to the Ten Commandments. The first five seem to be dealing with what should our relationship to God be. The second five are what should my relationship to my fellow man be. And when God was asked, when Jesus was asked to summarize the law, he says, love the Lord with all your heart. And then the second one is, love your neighbor as yourself. So Jesus was seeing it in that same way, that the Ten Commandments are fit into those two categories, or those two parts to the Ten Commandments. One of the things that Umberto Casuto is one of my favorite commentators. He's very, very insightful. He was a Jew who lived in Italy, he wrote in the 50s primarily, but took the text very seriously, and as a result wrote some wonderful stuff. But he makes a comment on the Ten Commandments in general and says that one of the things that emerges from the Ten Commandments in general, and especially as you read on in the Pentateuch, is the fact that God is presented differently here than people understood gods to be in the rest of the world. And in particular, God is being presented as a transcendent, as the transcendent God. Now, just to make this clear, in the ancient world, from the pagan perspective, gods were very important, powerful beings. They were divine. But, as such, they were still subject to the forces at play in the universe. They may have been very powerful, but they were still within this universe, a part of this universe. The God that's presented in the Pentateuch is not that kind of God. He is not subject to the laws at work in this universe. He is not subject to fate. The pagan gods were subject to fate. God is not subject to fate. God is the author of this creation. God is the author of fate. Casuto says, in the Torah's view, there is an absolute barrier between the creator and the created, which no creature in the world can transcend. And then he goes on, he talks about this unique relationship that God is bringing into being between the people of Israel and this one transcendent God. And he says, basically, this is what God is saying to them in this part of Exodus. I, the speaker, am called Yahweh, and I am your God specifically. Although I am the God of the whole earth, yet I am your God in the sense that you recognized me and sanctified your life, and it should be to my service. And I am also your God in the sense that, in consideration of this sanctification, I have chosen you to be the people of my special possession from among all the peoples of the earth. And it is I who brought you out of the land of Egypt, not just bringing you forth from one place to another, but liberating you from the house of bondage. Hence it behooves you to serve me not out of fear and dread, in the way that other peoples are used to worship their gods, but from a sense of love and gratitude. So that's the God that emerges out of these laws, but also the Pentateuch as a whole. And that had to have come as a surprise, as a revelation to the people of Israel. Maybe they had begun to understand that along a lot earlier. They should have, with the plagues, etc. But they are learning that in their lifetimes. The first word then, I'll read the first three verses. Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. So what we see here is that God is different from the other gods. This God, Yahweh, is a jealous God. He demands their exclusive worship and service. He's not sharing that with anyone. His right to receive his people's worship and obedience is his and his alone. The second word, you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven or above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and on the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. This had to be a surprise to them. He's saying, make no idols, make no representations of me. That would have been commonplace in the rest of the ancient Near East. They all would have made idols of their gods, and then they would have worshipped those idols. I suspect that my best guess as to what's going on here is that the problem with idols is that they're made by people. An idol is an attempt by humans to make God. That is, to form God. And in so doing, what they are inevitably going to do is make God to their liking. In one way or another, this result of their handiwork is going to be something that is amenable to them. Something that is simple, straightforward, is manipulable. Something that will serve their purposes. The prophets, and I remember this especially in Isaiah, he condemns those who worship idols. and says, it's ridiculous. I mean, you just made it. Why would you worship it? And the commentators say, well, Isaiah obviously didn't understand how idols work because they didn't really believe that that was what they were worshiping. They were worshiping the God that took up residence in that statue, not the statue itself. I suspect that Isaiah actually understood the mind of idolatry better than the commentator. And that is, when you strip it all away, you strip away all of the rationalization and all of the theological underpinnings of their idolatry and that sort of thing, what it comes down to is, it's a religion of their own making. That God is of their own making. It's a God that they made to their liking. If it's going to be that kind of God, it's going to be a tame God, and God is not a tame God. Furthermore, God can't be comprehended. I use that word carefully. I don't mean he can't be understood. I mean he can't be comprehended. That is to say, we can, to a large extent, understand God. God is a revealer of himself. He sets out to reveal himself to us. Clearly, we can understand God to an extent. But we can't understand him comprehensively. We can't understand him in his entirety. And my suspicion is that if you reduce God to a visual image, there's the illusion that we can. There's the illusion that we've got him figured out, that here he is. I know in my experience that whenever I have thought that I pretty well had God figured out, events would come along that would prove me wrong. That God is excellent at busting out of those times when we think that we've got God figured out. We know who he is and the kinds of things that he does. To a certain extent, we can figure that out. But to a certain extent, we can't. He will always surprise us. As Elul says, he's ever the creator. Okay. However, he is a jealous God. He can't be nailed down. But he is a gracious God. An incredibly gracious God. He will punish those for their iniquity to the third and fourth generation. But he shows loving kindness to those who obey him to the thousandth generation. So he gives people according to their deeds, but he is much more eager to be generous and gracious than he is to be punitive. The third word, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. This one appears to be dealing with a situation in which someone makes an oath, and in order to make it clear to the other person who's receiving this promise, that this promise is good, they swear by the name of God. Stewart says, with respect to this particular commandment, the primary meaning of misuse the name of the Lord, or take the Lord, name of God in vain, would appear to be invoking his name as a guarantor of one's words. Examples would include promising someone something by Yahweh, meaning, I guarantee you that my promise is true, or Yahweh may kill me or otherwise punish me if I don't keep my promise. So that seems to be what is in view here, is to not do that. That kind of practice makes sense in a situation where there is question as to whether someone will keep their word or not. And in an environment where there's question as to whether someone will keep their word, you have to make a stronger claim. So if you say, I promise to do X, if that's not good enough, then it's, I really promise to do X. And if that's not good enough, it's, I really, really promise to do X. And the highest you can go in that is, I promise in the name of God I will do that. So that's the way it's envisioned. And so the thinking is, if I go to that length, I'm really putting myself at risk. God could punish me. He could just zap me right then and there. So that is an oath that will be kept. The problem is, God doesn't do a lot of zapping. And as a result, you can have an environment in which that oath can be taken in the name of God, and someone can go against that oath, and they're still there the next day, and they're still there the day after that. And in that kind of environment, then, there is, that person has permission then to do more of that. I'll do more swearing in the name of God because nothing ever happens to me. So I think what is in view here is any kind of taking God lightly, being dismissive of him, being mocking of him in that kind of way, using him. In my notes, I have Israelite society is charged with punishing this, but that's not what it says. That's not quite right. It says, "For the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain." He may not get zapped the next day, but punishment will come. That person will be punished for what they've done, and that's what's being assured here. God is a holy God. God is not to be toyed with. God is not to be mocked. He may be patient and long-suffering, but punishment will be coming. The fourth word. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male or your female servant or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the earth, the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So God is establishing the Sabbath as a holy day. They remember earlier when God gave them manna, he told them, you can collect it on 6 days, but on the sixth day, collect twice as much because I don't want you to collect it on the seventh day. So the Sabbath, in a sense, has already existed. But here it has been codified. They are being instructed that this is an important practice for them to keep, and it has huge significance. There were other weeks in other parts of the ancient world. Some of the weeks were longer than 7 days. Someplace it was 8 days. I read someplace where it was 12 days. That'd be deadly. So seven is a little unusual. However, 7 days is not unheard of in the ancient world. In Mesopotamia, there was the notion that every seventh day was bad luck. And therefore, there are certain things that you shouldn't do on a seventh day, like sign a contract, or I can't remember, there's some other things that you shouldn't do. So this concept of a seven-day period is not unheard of, but it is invested here with a completely different significance. The basis for the Sabbath is it was 7 days that God was engaged in creative activity. For 6 days he worked, and on the seventh day he rested. So the Sabbath then becomes a weekly reminder of who God is, that is, the transcendent creator God, and that the people of Israel are to imitate him. Just as he spent 6 days working and one day resting when he created the world, they are to spend 6 days working and one day resting. And it is a holy day. Sarna points out that the first thing to be holy in the Old Testament is not a place, but a time, which is an interesting observation. It will also be a sign to the people of Israel. In Exodus 31:13, it says, I'll start with 12. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, 'You shall surely observe my Sabbaths. For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Therefore you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you.'" So it is a sign to them. And what is it a sign of? It's a sign of their relationship with God, that they have a unique relationship with God. And God is a holy God, and they are therefore to be a holy people. And the Sabbath is a reminder every week of the covenant that has been made and their status before God, and therefore their obligation before God. An author, Berman, makes an interesting comment. He said, holiness in the Old Testament is always something that is of use to God. It has some purpose in God's plans, and it is marked by having restrictions. Everything that is holy is marked by having restrictions. The Sabbath is holy and marked by having the restriction that there shall be no work on that day. The fifth word, verse 12, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. Honoring your father and your mother, that is a concept that is everywhere in the ancient world. I was reading in Plato's Laws, where he lays out a just polity for a society. And he's going through what should the laws of this society be. And in his prefatory remarks, one of the cornerstones is honoring one's parents. He calls it the most sacred of all our obligations. And the concept behind this, as Plato explains it, is they cooperated with God to bring us into being and spent years raising us up so that we could be independent human beings. And therefore, we owe honor to them. And furthermore, we owe honor not just to our parents, but to all of the generation that preceded us and the generations, because that which they put in place is that in which we have grown up and have enjoyed the order that was established. Okay. I suspect that this principle then can be extended beyond just parents to respect for authority in general. Now, there are limits on that, but we'll talk about that more next week. Then we come to the second set of commandments, and I'm going to do these very quickly because we have very little time. But I don't think much commentary is necessary. So the sixth one, you shall not murder. The seventh one, you shall not commit adultery. The eighth one, you shall not steal. The ninth one, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And my understanding of this is that it's primarily in a court setting. That is, you can't lie in a court with respect to what someone did. That's what's being prohibited here. But I'm sure that this is intended to have a wider application, that is, lying with an intent to do harm to someone. Then the last one, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now, this is unique. If you look at the other codes of the ancient Near East, you won't find one like this. Because this one is saying it's not prohibiting an action as much as it's prohibiting an attitude, a thought. Which then puts the former four commands into perspective, that you're not only supposed to not murder, you're supposed to not want to kill somebody to get what they've got. You're not only not supposed to commit adultery, you're not supposed to lust after the woman that you would commit adultery with. And we can go on down through these, that covetousness is behind the actions that are proscribed in the previous four commandments. So that is unique, and it's obviously raising the bar with respect to what God is requiring of us. But it's raising the bar in a way that is really helpful, because I'm sure you all understand and have experienced that if you allow your lust to run away with you, there are bad actions that will follow. But it has to be stopped earlier. It becomes very difficult to stop. And that's what the 10th commandment is recognizing. Another thing that we see that comes out here is we have parameters placed on us. There are all kinds of things that we want, that we all want. We all want life to be comfortable, to be good, to be pleasant. And the biggest obstacle to that is other people. I mean, that's a huge obstacle to that. And if they would just do what they're supposed to do, if they just do what I want them to do, then it'd be fine. But they won't. And as a result, it is always our desire to get people to do what we want them to do. And yet, what these commandments are doing is putting tight constraints on what it is that we can do to get other people to do what we want them to do. There are very tight constraints on that. And it's our job to be content and recognize God knows what he's doing. He has allotted to me what he has allotted to me. If he hasn't given me $1 million, that's good and proper. He knows what he's doing. I don't need to steal it. And to steal it would be going beyond my boundaries. I have tight boundaries as a creature that God has placed me in, and I need to stay within my boundaries. Okay. We'll stop there, and then there's much more I need to clean up here and talk about. I better not take any. We're already over time. I won't take any questions. If you have questions or comments, please write them down, and I'll take them next week.